This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The BFM Breakfast Grill. Top interviews you can't afford to miss. Presented by the CIMB Group.
Good morning. Welcome to the Breakfast Grill. Today we are talking to Garrick Hallman, an expert on Bitcoin and alternative currencies. Garrick currently teaches a course on comparative national economic performance at the London School of Economics. He also founded Macro Digest, a macroeconomic news and analysis website. Good morning, Garrick, and welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, we're going to obviously talk about your field of expertise today, which is Bitcoins. And first of all, can you just tell us why are you so fascinated with Bitcoins?
So I study currencies more generally. As an economic historian, I first started studying black market currencies in the 1940s, also looking at alternative currencies. And Bitcoin, when it came onto the scene, the public scene a few years back, really caught my attention as something that was quite different from any other alternative currency that we'd seen in history. It has some similarities, but also some important differences, which we can discuss if that's of interest.
Okay. Why did a cryptocurrency like Bitcoins come about? Because obviously over the last few years, we've seen a lot of discontentment about inequality and anger about how money printing presses by the central banks all over the world was just a conduit into the coffers of the rich. Was Bitcoin a response to that, or was this just a clever money-making idea?
Well, there's been a lot of interest in alternative currencies in general for hundreds of years, and interestingly, there are some patterns that tend to hold in terms of when alternative currencies come into existence. There were quite a few during the Great Depression, and they do seem to pop up in large quantities after some kind of socioeconomic dislocation, like what we saw in the 2008 financial crisis. So Bitcoin, the original paper was published by Satoshi Nakamoto in November 2008. So this is right after Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, very much right in the heat of the financial crisis. And it's an interesting coincidence of timing, because people had been working on cryptocurrencies and trying to improve the technology really that underpins them for years. A real breakthrough, a real innovation, this solution to the double spending problem, which Bitcoin has, coincided with the financial crisis, which is quite interesting. So I think it was a combination of both a technical breakthrough in conjunction with the kind of macroeconomic conditions, which have really propelled Bitcoin to its current status.
I think it's quite interesting when you mentioned the confluence of the crisis, the economic crisis of 2008, as well as that coincided with what we would think is some of the best technological advancements that we have made in years. And do you think that because Bitcoin is supported by some degree of high technology, that this would be able to have a longer shelf life than some of the other cryptocurrencies that you talked about in the Depression era?
Yes. So my research has shown that alternative currencies tend to die a very quick death, relative at least to fiat currencies. The ones that were launched in the Depression, the free geld is a good example of this. Launched in 1932, was regulated out of existence by the Austrian Central Bank in 1933. But much more commonly, the scrip currencies that we saw in the United States, they just simply died due to lack of demand after a short period of time. They were inconvenient, weren't very compelling. Bitcoin has, I think, at least four key differences to traditional alternative currencies. One is it's much easier to transact across international borders. It's very low friction. It has a global brand. It's not a currency that's just tied to a local community. It also has very powerful institutions that are backing it. Venture capitalists have put in excess of $100 million into Bitcoin. And so these features really distinguish it from traditional alternative currencies and suggest that it may have a much longer life and may take a different course than what we've seen historically.
And a lot of people are actually quite leery about what looks like creating money out of thin air. Can you tell us a little bit about the technology that goes behind how a Bitcoin is mined?
Sure. Well, I think the creators were very concerned about that as well. And so what they did is they set a limit on the total number of Bitcoins that can ever come into existence. There's roughly about 12 million today that have been mined. We can talk more about mining if that's of interest. But by the year 2140, the last Bitcoin will be mined, and there only will ever be 21 million. And as you can probably tell, given that Bitcoin's only been around for about 6 years now, you know, there is a much steeper initial mining, speed of mining to bring the 12 million online. And then that starts to slow down. And in this way, the creators were hoping to somewhat mirror, you know, metallic-based currencies like gold that have a limited or fixed supply, out of a fear of, you know, excessive money printing, out of a fear of devaluing Bitcoin. They wanted to keep the value high by keeping it scarce.
Now, why did Ben Bernanke give it a cautious nod?
This is a very interesting question, and I haven't received firm confirmation of this, but one thing people should know is that prior to joining the faculty at Princeton, which was where Ben Bernanke was when he before he became a Federal Reserve Board member, he actually was on the faculty at Stanford in Silicon Valley for quite a long time. And no doubt, you know, developed relationships with people in the community there, saw firsthand the power of technical innovation and the kind of positive impact that can have on economic growth. And my theory is, you know, with this firsthand awareness of, you know, the importance of innovation in an economy, and possibly also with relationships that you know, are still in place with Silicon Valley, you know, Ben maybe took a slightly different perspective on this than many of his peers, you know, in the economics community who have been very, very negative about Bitcoin, very much see it as a you know, potential return to the gold standard if it were to gain mainstream attraction or widespread attraction. You know, it's also important to note that Ben was very close to the end of his term when he made those comments. So perhaps he was feeling a little more open to taking a risk with some of his public words. And then the other reason I think that was important in terms of why Ben said what he said was there had been a number of really high-profile hackings of large retailers like Target and others where we saw a lot of identity theft. And the anonymity around Bitcoin, the security features around the currency could actually help address what's a real serious problem and leads to hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in theft globally each year.
Now enter Mt. Gox, so over 700,000 coins and 300 million almost dollars later in losses and a lot of angry people. Is confidence in Bitcoin's forever shaken?
Well, those are the rumored numbers. We still haven't received confirmation of that, but it's looking more likely that those numbers could be correct. The Mt. Gox story is far from over. It's been very frustrating, I think, for everyone that the team at Mt. Gox has not been more forthcoming to explain what's been going on, what the problem is. It certainly looks highly suspicious, and I think everyone is best off assuming the worst, that this is the largest theft or fraud or disaster in Bitcoin history. I mean, we've seen wallets get hacked or people run off with money, you know, in the few million dollar range in the past. So this is, you know, one or two orders of magnitude larger than anything we've seen before. And it certainly is a huge blow to Bitcoin's brand. You simply can't have a theft of this size, you know, roughly 5% of all Bitcoins in existence, without people, you know, suffering a large loss of confidence. The Mt. Gox brand was also one of the early brands that really was associated with Bitcoin. So it is an important blow. But at the same time, I do think that, you know, Bitcoin has suffered from a number of setbacks and has been written off quite a few times before. There's been, you know, some famous headlines in magazines like Wired in 2011 about the rise and fall of Bitcoin after the price crashed from over $30 down to $2. So Bitcoin's been very resilient and has bounced back. I think the important thing for people to know is it's still a very immature technology. There's going to be problems. We're seeing kind of this first wave of entrepreneurs like Mark Capellas at Mt. Gox and Charlie Shrem, who is the vice chairman of the Bitcoin Foundation, who was arrested. We're seeing them kind of go by the wayside in newer more seasoned entrepreneurs are coming in, which if you're a Bitcoin fan, will hopefully bring more stability and professionalism to Bitcoin.
I'm speaking with Garrick Heilman, an expert on Bitcoins. And after this, we will continue to talk about the macro environment and socioeconomic implications of Bitcoins.
Best for money, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back. I'm speaking with Garrick Heilman. He's an expert on Bitcoins and alternative currencies. He also teaches a course on comparative national economic performance at the London School of Economics. Now, Garrick, a lot of comments have come out after the Mt. Gox collapse that the exchange or Bitcoins in general need some degree of self-regulation, and without it, it wouldn't ever work. And this was the kind of criticism that was leveled at Bitcoins. What forms of regulation, if at all, does something like Bitcoin need?
I mean, that's a really, you know, important and I think rather complex question. And there's certainly very different views within the Bitcoin community, even within the regulatory community on that. On the one hand, I think people are concerned, perhaps rightly so, that too much regulation could squash some of the innovation. But at the same time, you know, if we could put safeguards in place to protect people's money from these kinds of disasters, you know, and these could be either, you know, internal industry safeguards, self-policing, if you will, or some external safeguards so that the authorities know how to actually pursue criminals and recoup losses like what we're seeing potentially here with Mt. Gox. I mean, these would be undoubtedly very valuable, I think, to Bitcoin's prospects. The average person who is not, you know, a computer programmer, you know, is not interested in dealing with a lot of the headaches and complexities that Bitcoin requires today if you're going to be, say, holding Bitcoins. There's terms like cold storage where you remove your Bitcoins from the cloud and, you know, basically keep the codes offline. You know, that's a hassle for a lot of people that they don't want to deal with. And so regulatory safeguards, something like deposit or broker insurance that we have with our existing financial institutions, I think could be an important thing to putting people's minds at ease, that their money's safe. And if something does go wrong, like at our banks today, you know, there's a very strong likelihood that someone's going to step in and make sure you get your money back. And that just doesn't exist with Bitcoin today, but I think it would help if it did.
How does this all this talk about regulation compare to the idea of gold? Because gold is some kind of quasi-money. And does gold have any regulation?
Well, it does in certain corners of the world. There are some restrictions on imports and exports. There's a price fixing that takes place here in London where the bullion banks get together and kind of set the price, similar to how the LIBOR price fixing was taking place. That's being investigated now for price fixing concerns. So there's some regulation even around the pricing of gold. So, you know, whether or not these types of regulations would be helpful for Bitcoin or even, I don't think what you could take what's, you know, the regulatory aspects of gold and transfer those to Bitcoin. But there could be some things that I think would really help consumers get more comfortable transacting and holding Bitcoins on the regulatory side. But again, I think the Bitcoin community needs to kind of recognize that and appreciate that. There's still a lot of people who are very resistant to that idea and think that's going to kill the goose, so to speak.
And there's also a lot to be said about the democratizing effects of Bitcoin because anybody can learn how to mine Bitcoin. Is this a democratizing factor, or is that easier said than done?
That's a really interesting question. So I wrote about this a little bit in a piece I published on Project Syndicate about how the blockchain, which is the public record where all transactions, Bitcoin transactions, are stored, all of us can download this the software. And in some ways, when we do that and we begin the process of mining Bitcoins and keeping the public ledger on our computers, which is shared across all the computers which run the mining network, you know, we collectively become what is, in the real world, the bank. We have the record of who's transacting with who and who owns what. And in some ways, it does open up the financial system to a more collective kind of ownership. I compared it to a return to community banking. But having said that, I think it's really important to recognize a couple of problems with the existing Bitcoin system that make it inaccessible to a number of people. So mining has gotten very expensive. You will have to buy computers that can cost upwards of $10,000-$20,000, and it's very energy intensive. And so, you know, if the price of Bitcoin were to fall too low, say below $50, you know, or perhaps even higher than that, it would no longer be profitable to mine Bitcoins. And so there is a digital divide. There is concern about the attractiveness of mining. Say once the supply is exhausted of new Bitcoins. And so other alternative currencies like Litecoin, for example, which is the number two alternative currency, don't require as sophisticated hardware to mine. And there's some currencies where they're just giving away the currency to try to make it more accessible. And this is where Bitcoin could be potentially vulnerable to a competitor, which is seen as even more democratic, more accessible, and has fewer digital divide problems.
And also earlier, you were talking about how the creators have set a limit on the number of Bitcoins. Currently, 6 years into its creation, we're talking about existence of 12 million supply of Bitcoins, and the limit is 21 million, and that's almost half of the preset limit. And actually, this brings us back to the gold-backed system, where if there were not enough gold to expand development, and that's the reason why central banks the world over went into money creation. Is that going to be a problem with, let's say, a fully functioning Bitcoin system for economic development?
I think so. I think economists have gotten a little ahead of themselves when they've, you know, criticized Bitcoin for having a limited supply. What I think everyone needs to keep in mind is that it is an alternative currency, and there's no problem with it having a limited supply if it were just to remain an alternative to existing national currencies. But if a country were to adopt it, then there could be a serious problem, because one of the things that we need to do when the economy is growing is we need to increase the supply of currency that's in circulation. Currency is very much kind of the grease of an economy. It lubricates the purchase of goods and services. And if you have a fixed supply of money in a growing economy, you can really choke economic growth. So that would be an issue. Say a country like Zimbabwe wanted to adopt Bitcoin instead of the U.S. dollar. It had a foreign policy grief with the U.S. and didn't want to use their currency. That's a potential problem, because Bitcoin is, you know, still growing in supply now, but someday it won't, and there's no control from the authorities on that currency, really. So this is where I think you could see alternatives to Bitcoin, or even Bitcoin itself, change its rules someday and actually allow for a growing supply. That's not out of the question. It would just take a majority of the mining community to actually approve that kind of change.
And talking about competitors, which are, of course, as you say, mushrooming right now, how will this play out? Because this would have some kind of undermining effects on the position of Bitcoins, and ultimately it may have the potential to destroy any chances of any the survival of any viable alternative medium of exchange, because now we have, you know, the Litecoins, the Dogecoins, Tesla coins, Elephant coins, and so on.
It's a big question. I mean, even before the cryptocurrencies emerged, there were some 4,000 roughly alternative currencies in existence. These are mostly local currencies, physical banknotes, fake banknotes that were used to transact local commerce in communities, like here in London, the Brixton region. But this competition is a potential problem for Bitcoin. You know, Bitcoin has a huge lead with its first mover advantage, its global brand, and the closest competitor, Litecoin, has actually fallen back a bit. It used to be about a tenth of the size in terms of its total market cap of Bitcoin. It's now about 20th of the size, which is interesting because, as you mentioned, Dogecoin and other alternatives to Bitcoin have been getting more attention lately. So Bitcoin still really has a commanding lead, and I think a lot of the support in terms of the development community, venture capital community, is really lined up squarely behind Bitcoin. So I don't see there being a significant threat to Bitcoin in the near term. But Bitcoin has some technical issues. Transactions take about 10 minutes to process. The mining operation is relatively expensive. You know, these are things that can be changed. Bitcoin can be reprogrammed, but but other currencies are already addressing some of these issues. And, you know, my research on alternative currencies suggests that one of the leading causes of death is technological innovation. And so the Bitcoin community is really concerned about regulation, and perhaps rightfully so. But I think they should actually be a little more concerned about a technological competitor coming along and really doing Bitcoin better and really taking off.
Can we just spend some time talking about the idea of fiat currencies? I mean, things like paper money and gold and things like Bitcoin are really fiats that try to represent a real value. Will we come to the ultimate form of exchange that is truly representative of value, which is found in the barter system, right? Because the barter has kind of equalizing properties. Is this a viable option in this day and age of high technology?
Well, barter confronts what economists call the double coincidence of wants, right? Where if I have my cow and you've got your horse, if I want a horse and I have a cow, I have to find someone who has a horse, which is quite inconvenient oftentimes, whereas money, we can transact in that. So I don't see barter really coming back in a major way. It's just too inefficient.
If I may just stop you there, sure, a moment. That used to be the case for barter, but in today's technology, there are ways to account for degrees of indebtedness, the degrees of divisibility that was not possible before in the past.
Mm. Well, I might have something to learn on this. Even with sophisticated technology, it would still seem that there is a value in having a medium like money to help make things more efficient. But perhaps I could be proven wrong. I mean, certainly that would be the most basic form of or way of transacting, which I think a lot of people, that would make a lot of sense to them on a very intuitive level in terms of how that would work. But I'd have to see how that could work from a practical perspective.
And also, the idea is also the fact that, there are many of us who would like to take the ability to manage the economy perhaps away from the power of the central banks. And with the boom and bust cycles, the policies of boom and bust, is a currency that takes that power away from central banks a good thing?
This is a huge question with, I think, no simple answer. I mean, certainly money is something that we have. It's a social, social good. It's not a naturally occurring good. It's something that we create. It's a construct. In some ways, it operates like memory. If we had perfectly distributed trust and memory of who owns what, who's transacted with who, then we wouldn't really need money. That's really what its function is fundamentally. And so removing that from the public institutions, from government, from a central bank, from the laws, that's something I think we need to think carefully about as a society, about whether we really want to do that. I think in countries which have, misused money, thinking of Argentina and Zimbabwe, I could see a lot of people very much wanting to take the central bank and the government out of the equation and have money managed. And that's what's happened when countries have dollarized and adopted someone else's money. But other countries where there's been a better management of the currency, I think there might be a little more fear about taking this public good and making it more private. But it's an interesting question, and I think we're at a really interesting juncture in monetary history where we're going to see some competition with private money against public money. And, there's good reasons to want that. I think the current financial system is very inefficient. It's very expensive. It's been consuming a much larger share of GDP. And this is a concern, for anyone who's interested in economic growth, seeing more and more resources extracted by the financial services sector, that's money that could be invested in more productive areas of the economy. So I personally am very happy to see this kind of competition in currencies taking place today.
Garrick, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I hope that we will be able to speak again soon sometime in the future to track the course of this historic development.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That was Garrick Hallman, an expert of Bitcoin and alternative currencies. I'm Julian Ng, and you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.